Welcome to Embracing the Muse. I'm your host, Sally Jean Fox, the author of Meeting the Muse After Midlife. And I'm on a quest to discover and understand how we can live our richest, most meaningful, and creative lives at any age, and especially as we age. And I'll be interviewing island creatives to discover what they can share with us about the highs and lows, ups and downs, and possibilities of living and sustaining a creative life. Hi, friends. I am so excited today to attempt the impossible. I'm going to bring you two of my favorite creative friends on the island, David Milka and Thomas Hitoshi Prixma. We were just talking about the importance of that middle name that is now part of his creative presence. The thing that's so impossible about this interview, though, is that I want to interview each of them as creatives, and I want to find out about their amazing creative partnership. So I think I'm going to have to admit a certain defeat at the beginning and invite them both back because they have such a creative legacy, both as individuals and as partners in creativity and partners in life. So thank you guys so much.
Sure. We're happy to be here.
Yeah, a real pleasure.
Now, the first hard task I'm going to try and tackle is giving you a short form of their bios. The longer form can be found on the show notes for Embracing the Muse at Voice of Vashon. So David was born in Campbell River, British Columbia, where an extraordinary teacher named Marie Rackham helped him turn his life around when he dropped back into high school after running away at the age of 15. And if any of you saw their extraordinary joint venture, a performance called Gay Beret that's now has another title as well, I think you call it the Driftwood Bridge, you probably already fell in love with Marie. She was a central character in the background of this amazing performance they did together. David went on to work in LA as an actor and singer. He appeared in regional theaters and on episodic TV, and he created and performed one-person musical stage shows for corporate, private, and charitable events under the banner of his company, The Rainbow Man Productions. He's also the producer of an award-winning video series, Cozy Grammar, inspired by Marie Rackham. So, David, thank you. And there's so much more, but I can't share it all yet.
That's plenty.
And Tom is an author, poet, translator, teacher, magician, musician, and lover of life. Since 2001, he's devoted his life to the highest possibility of words and their power to join our hearts across time and place. He was born in Seattle and has lived and worked in Tamil Nadu, India, and Oaxaca, Mexico. And his new translation of the classic Tamil masterpiece on ethics, power, and love, The Chorale, You say it, Tom.
Thiruvalluvar's Thirukkural.
Thank you. There. Was published by Beacon Press and awarded the 2025 Ancient Tamil Literature Promotion Award by the government of Tamil Nadu that also brought him to India for a recent tour. I would say that getting an award like that could be the pinnacle of one's creative career. I mean, it is such an honor to be recognized by the community, both of Tamil Nadu expatriates who are living in the States and also over in India. So super congratulations on that. It's amazing. And I know you're up to other things, translating Juan Rulfo's masterpiece, Pedro Paramo, and a novel about music, adolescence, ecology, and time. Oh my gosh, that's why I say I cannot fit you guys into a small slot here. But I want to talk about your creative journey. And here's what I remember on a personal level as part of my intro to you both. I met you, Tom, actually, and you will not remember this because it was probably 15 plus years ago on a Washington State ferry.
I do remember this.
Do you? Really?
Oh, yes.
You had
plants in the back of your vehicle that you were salvaging from, I think, some place they were like some sort of landscaping rearrangement or building project.
Well, I was working
project.
With Plant Amnesty where...
Plant Amnesty.
Yeah, where donors in Seattle who don't have room for a vegetable garden and a cherry tree can put their cherry tree up for adoption. to the right owner. And I was often the right owner. So I'd go to Seattle and I'd bring back trees. It was totally crazy. But on deck, you were talking with my friend Stephen Silla, our mutual friend, and you were talking about your writing life and how you were getting up at 5 a.m. or earlier to write every day. And I don't know whether you were working on a poetry book or on a translation, but I thought, you know, you hear about the old adage that writers write and that you have to be disciplined and it's great if you can write every day. But here's someone who's actually doing it, and not only doing it, but doing it with the discipline of getting up every morning. And then, David, I met you through our mutual friend, Myrna Hecht, a poet
yes.
on the island.
Glad to see you doing that lovely one-woman piece where you were embodying that woman from the Killing Field experience. And
yeah.
And it was just such a beautifully done piece. So that was a lovely way to encounter you for the first time.
Yeah, I love that. And you know, as a performer, that the quality of the listening in an audience shapes the performance. And both of you were there, and both of you were so present. And I've always appreciated that about you. However I find you, whether it's on the street in a Zumba class or at a performance, you bring this depth of presence and soulfulness that always inspires me. So I have appreciated following your creative path because I know something about what you bring, you know, that approach. And like Tom, I think you value words and you value ideas.
Yes.
So I was thinking about those crazy shows on television where they bring a couple together, and like a married couple, and then they ask them questions like, do you really know each other?
Oh, the Newlywed Game or whatever.
Yeah, or something like that. Yeah. Yeah. And you've been together for a while now, so I think you do. But I want to find out about your individual creative paths and also the partnership that you have. So I want to start by asking, maybe I'll ask Tom first, can you describe David as a creative? What stands out to you about his creative path, both the light that seems to pull him forward and, if you're willing, the challenges that he sometimes stumbles over?
That's a tall order.
It's a huge order.
It's a juicy question.
I
love it.
And I don't have a toaster to award you. So.
Well, you know, I'll just say the first thing that comes to mind is an extraordinary intuitive capacity to respond to the moment, to be spontaneous, whether he's spontaneously writing something that he will then go on to perform, or whether he's performing his own work, or whether he's interpreting the work that somebody else has written. What always impresses me is an ability to be completely in the moment and to follow his own inklings second by second, reflecting in the way he glances, the movement of his body, the very light and flashing intelligence in his eyes, all of these things. And I think for somebody who has such a capacity, especially when in a venue with a live audience, where there's a kind of energetic dialogue that takes place between David and the members of the audience, where there's a, for the audience may not be speaking, but they are speaking with their energy, with their listening, with how they are present to what he's saying, and there's an extraordinary, unrepeatable conversation that happens in those moments that I'm always amazed by. Mm-hmm. And I think the challenge for somebody who has at least that as one large part of their presence as an artist, as a performer, as a writer, is that to be able to trust that intuitive sense that a person has is not always easy. I know from my own experience that I am often juggling between the spontaneous impulse to say something or to do something and the side of my mind in this case that is the editor or the critic or the judge, or it's like, oh, you can't do that. Oh, what will people think if you do that? And I've watched David particularly over the years we've been together, particularly in the last, I'd say, 5, even 10 years, really making a wonderful, coming to be able to acknowledge, but also not be stymied by those voices that would inhibit that spontaneity, that would inhibit that creativity.
Right. That's a beautiful way of talking about it, because, and can you move a little closer to your mic when you talk next? The gift of intuition and improvisation is so rich. And yet we live in a left brain, right brain kind of balanced world where you also want to up your game and keep improving, which then allows that other voice to come in and wonder if it was good enough. But so I totally get that. Let me ask you one more question before we turn the tables. The acting world is often a world of appearances and a certain amount of glamour, you know, and how does David stay away from the sinkhole if he experiences it of celebrityhood, and am I getting my, you know, the parts that I want, and is the world acknowledging me? Is that an issue for him?
That's a great question. I think it's an issue for anybody who wants their work to be seen, heard, read, looked at, listened to. I think for different people, there's a different set of priorities, balances, a different kind of dance that goes on. I've never seen David, when he is doing his work, when he's performing, when he is present to an audience, all of those concerns that a person can have, I think they just vanish, because there is a capacity to be present to that particular group of people who may be there, whether it's 2 or 2,000 people. And I think that the question of, you know, how one's work is received in sort of a larger public sense is akin to that same critical voice that says, oh, this isn't good enough. Oh, this, nobody will like this. Nobody will listen. Who cares about what you have to say? And so as I've watched David continue to grow as an artist, I've watched him also be able to balance the side of us that naturally enough does want to be seen with the side of us that has something deeply meaningful and precious to offer an audience, a listener, a reader. Mm-hmm. And as that journey continues, I guess I just get to watch
how beautiful
he refines that capacity.
Yeah, that's so key. I mean, the gremlins don't go away, and we live in a very externally focused world.
Mm-hmm.
And so having the strength to be able to deal with the gremlins and yet keep growing creatively.
Yeah,
so David, did he get
challenge.
It right?
Yeah, that was lovely.
And what would
Thank
you add?
You,
what would you add?
Oh, to what? To that?
Yeah.
I would totally agree. A lot of it is grappling with the shadows, for sure. A lot of it from the past, you know, growing up as a perceived as a sort of effeminate kid, and then people putting gay connotations on that at a young age, you know, back in the 60s and
in 70s
when I grew up
less.
In Campbell
yeah.
River in the kind of, you know, backwoods. And
right.
And it was still, you know, I was born for the first 6 years I was alive. It was still considered a criminal offense to be a homosexual in Canada, so
right.
where I grew up. So that attitude was very pervasive and not always blatantly. I mean, it would be blatant if you were perceived as acting like a girl, if you were interested in playing with dolls instead of having to go out and hunt or something. But in more insidious ways, too. Like, I remember I had a kindergarten teacher there who meant well, and she was a very loving, open person, grandmotherly kind of figure, and so I was very drawn to her warm hugginess. But she called my parents in and thought I should be taken to Vancouver and have hormone treatments to fix me, you know, so that and she really believed that would be for my best interest. So, and her attitudes about, like, I remember we had to pick a decal sticker to put on our little lockers, and I picked Daisy Duck, and she was upset that I'd picked this girl duck instead of a boy duck. So, you know, even though she meant well, all that you suck that in and you internalize that. And then a lot of those shadows that I grapple with today, I found in my work, go back to that, to those times.
I could imagine, and tell me if I'm right on this, that you probably had a couple-fold thing going on. One, you know, the curse of homophobic reality in it's still out in the world today, but mm-hmm. it was really strong then, and growing up as a kid and having to tackle it from tiny years on. But also, I imagine that you're a sensitive. And I speak that as someone who is a sensitive herself, which means that we feel the world.
Yeah, you feel things very intensely, including feeling if you get a sense that somebody doesn't like, or their energy feels judging of you, or hyper sensitive, too sensitive to that probably, and can be apt to own that in a way that can be very inhibiting. If I go into an audition room, for example, and I feel that, or even, you know, from an audience, if you get a whiff of a wave of that, it can be very inhibiting to me. But I've learned over the years, you know, how do you contend with that?
You're going into an audition where their job is to judge you.
Is to judge you. And that's okay. I mean, there's judgment that's open-hearted, kind of supportive judgment in that professional sense. And then there's also what feels more personal, where you're just suddenly, you remind them of their uncle, whatever, that they didn't like. Or, you know, I've learned not to take any of that personally, or to be so self-centered to assume it really has anything. They don't really know me.
Right.
But that's taken many years to kind of have the consciousness in the moment, in the presence in the moment, to feel that pulling in, that batten down the hatches, we're being judged in a negative way, we're going to be rejected, danger. And recognize it for what it is. It's more about them than me.
Yeah, but it's hard. I mean, I've noticed that there only a couple of times, but, you know, when I'm facing judgment or disappointment and I'm either on stage or with a group of people, it's so hard because there's just like, you have to be here for these people. And your mind is on loudspeaker, you know, humiliation, you're being judged, blah, blah, blah. And then you're going, but I have to be here, you know?
Yeah.
So it's like a double thing going on.
I found it helped me to remind myself in those moments that I'm just there to offer something, you know, like for that moment. And it always comes back to presence for me, cultivating presence, because I don't think you can live really creatively unless you are conscious of being present, because creativity lives in the present moment.
Right.
So if I remind myself that I prepared this and I think of it, if it's say in an audition, which are usually the most intensive areas where that feeling of can happen, I don't think of it. I try not to think about an outcome. So then that takes away any worry of what they think. It's just in the present. Am I connecting with my intention of what I wanted to bring?
Wow.
And that I find that really frees up a lot of that stuff.
Yeah, it does. But it also feels like it requires a lot of inner work and discipline to be able to
yes,
go there.
Yeah, years of that.
Years of that.
And well, ongoing.
Let's turn the tables now. Uh-huh. That was, you did good. You get the little bell, you know, and I don't have a toaster, but, you know. how would you describe Tom's creative life? What the great gift that he brings in, as well as any particular challenge that he may encounter as a creative?
Well, the first word that comes to mind is discipline. In the true sense of sort of the root of discipline, you know, being connected to the word disciple, in the sense of being a disciple, I think I define discipline as being a disciple to your best self or your authentic self, and doing whatever it takes to honor that authentic self and bring it to life as best you can. And Tom, to me, has always personified that right from when we first met, as you were mentioning, remembering his conversation with that. That's true. I mean, he was getting up at 5:30, 6 in the morning every day. And when I first met him, he was going through all these poems that he'd had memorized every morning, like on cards, and he'd be running through those. And then he'd be working on his languages, and then he'd be doing his writing. And, you know, from the time he got up at 5:30 or 6 until usually, you know, about 1 or 1:30 in the afternoon, it was verboten to kind of interrupt that. And that was challenging for us as a couple initially, because again, I'm more in sort of do-do-do-do-do in the moment. And I would know that that's how he felt. But if I suddenly, you know, got some cool idea or had some interesting thought that I wanted to share with him, I would just run over and invade his bubble and start to share it, thinking, well, if I'm excited about it, he would be too. And I had to learn to honor that that bubble was sacred. And because we were living, we set up our original space when we first moved in together into a 20-foot yurt with the intention of knowing it would force us to have to cultivate authentic, really good communication skills. So when we're both working at home, you know, we're sort of back to back so that you feel like you're kind of working in solitude, but the other person's there. So it was really easy for me to sort of violate his space in that sense. And initially I would be daunted by that and feel like, you know, it was squelching to my spontaneity that he didn't want to hear it till later and take it personally, like a rejection. But once I came to realize it had nothing again to do with me and it was his practice, and honoring and respecting that, and also realizing, you know, if I was in the middle of being focused on something and he did that to me, I didn't like it either. You know, we don't want to have that focus broken when we're really cooking, right? Then I came to really value his modeling of that kind of discipline and seeing, you know, I had this weird thing, I think, that if you're super disciplined in that kind of structured way, that it was stultifying to your creativity. It would squish it. It would kill it. But I've seen it's the opposite. That organization, that discipline frees your creativity. Showing up every day, I think of it like the muses will bring you their treasures. Only so much will they knock and offer. And if you keep closing the door on their face and don't embrace them, you know, and honor that they've brought them to you and respect that and do the best you can with those little lovely inklings that come to you, then they'll go up to someone else.
Yeah. Well, I love the way you spoke about the origins of discipline and disciple, because I like to write in my book, I wrote about devoted discipline, because I think discipline and love, when you love what you're doing, it totally transforms it. Then discipline is a servant to that love. If it's without love, if it's out of to-do and shoulds and things like that, has a whole different quality. But we both know that there's that devotion behind what he's doing. Where does he stumble?
Well, again, I would say it connects to that, to being overly, or, you know, overly hard on yourself to live up to an extremely high standard. And over the years, it's been really cool for me to see how much he's become much more flexible and kind of, you know, in the moment with that discipline. And it's made a big difference, I think, to just freeing up his writing, his creativity, to make it freer. And, you know, that level of intensity has its shadows, as I have my shadows. His shadows, I think, were connected to feeling like you had to always live up to a certain standard. And it would be as if having a judge in your head that's constantly making sure that you're, you know, making yourself exhausted every day to justify your existence, kind of. But the lovely thing with us as a couple, I think, is that it's helped me. I've gotten more discipline and he's gotten more spontaneity.
Sweet.
So it's been a lovely mutual thing like that. Yeah.
Well, I want to ask more about the partnership, but first I want to hear from Tom. Did he get it right?
Oh, yeah. No, that's a beautiful way to put it.
Yeah.
You know, there have been times when in my desire to become a better writer, to be a better poet, to be a better reader of poetry, that I've not necessarily consciously, but given myself a kind of formula. Well, thereby, if I get up at 5:30 in the morning, then that will be the answer. And that can be an answer for a time. But there is also a danger of becoming too rigid and one's discipline becoming too much of a kind of hollow framework. And I've come to see even just, you know, when I write as it's a form, but it's a form that changes. It may change with the seasons. It may change with circumstances. For instance, when we were in New York last summer, David was in a play off Broadway, and I would go to performances, and I would be up late, and so it would make sense to get up a little later the next morning, and learning to be okay with that, because the voice that says this is the only way to do it is almost always wrong. This may be one way to do it, but I've learned many more ways to shape, you know, even just the shape of a day. When I'm doing my writing, when I'm doing meditation, when I'm, you know, just lazing around, which is very hard for me to do. But I've gotten better at that too.
Yes. Do you have a particular spiritual discipline or a practice that you follow?
I have such a menagerie. I have no idea how to tell you.
Yeah.
What I can say is that particularly the last 15 years or so, that's become, and even before that, it's important. It has been important to me to have a kind of practice, even as that practice is also constantly changing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, nourished in part by having grown up in a Christian household, nourished in part by my mother's Okinawan American family, who continue to be, many of them in Hawaii and on Maui. There's a way that we honor our ancestors that continues to be deeply important to me. I have a kind of meditative practice. I have a practice that has to do with dreams that in the last 3 years I've been paying very close attention to my dreams and working with somebody who has great insight into dreams. All of those pieces weave in and out in their own ways.
One of the things that has amazed and impressed me about your work is that it feels like you follow your own North Star in terms of what interests you and what you love. It doesn't seem to me that you're looking out for what will be the next bestseller or top the charts or whatever, but it feels like there's a question or a love that's behind the work that you're willing to give yourself to. Is that correct?
There is, yes. I think that is a fitting way to put it.
Yeah.
I just yesterday was having a conversation with a novelist who writes in Spanish, and she was interested in whether I'm interested in translating stuff for her work. And I told her the truth, which is that I don't get to choose. Everything that I've translated, I've never thought, oh, I better translate this poet, this novel, or whatever. It's chosen me. And then, you know, either I do it happily or I resist it and unhappy until I, you know, break down and say yes to it. Conversely, when I have, there have been a couple times when I've chosen, particularly with translation, it seems to be the case, where I've chosen work that I thought, oh, this ought to be translated because it's important work or whatever. But without that internal yearning, that internal desire, it's just a slog. It's just labor, in the worst sense.
Yeah, well, David talked about listening for the muse, you know, by showing up. And it sounds like you've got a very tuned in connection with the muse that, like, go here. This is an ought to. This isn't a do. You know,
well, I'm continually learning to tune in.
Right.
And continually learning what that means, because what tuning in meant 5 years ago, 1 year ago, a month ago, may not be what it is now.
Right.
Because as my perceptions become more clear, as I'm more able to recognize what is just old conditioning about what ought to be done, then I become more sensitive to what it seems I most want to do, which includes the very difficult periods where I don't know, when I don't have a very clear sense of this is what I need to be doing, because that's when it's very easy for me to try to concoct something like, oh, well, I've done this, therefore I should do this other thing. Mm-hmm. But without that genuine pull, for me, nothing happens. And so learning to be patient with the times that seem to be fallow, when the times that seems nothing is coming, that I think has been the hardest part of the true discipline I've tried to cultivate.
I asked David about, you know, being in audition and working with the Gremlins and stuff. Mm-hmm. Do you ever worry how you're going to support yourself with a particular project, you know, whether there'll be a, a grant, a market, you know, enough readership to pull it along? Or are you able to focus on the process and the call to do the work and let some of that handle itself?
When I'm working, meaning when I'm writing, when I'm actually at my desk or walking or thinking about the work, I have no problem. But when I'm not in that process, then of course I worry about. And, you know, writing is such a funny thing because it's not like I'm not currently in the position where people sort of commission something or I have an advance already in place.
Right.
I have to write it and then maybe it will sell. I mean, and I've written a number of manuscripts that haven't yet been sold. They may or may not be sold ever. And I live with that. And it's a very strange tension because I knew I had to write them. Maybe I had to write them and not have them published. Maybe I had to write them and one day they will be published. But each project, so the novel I'm working on now, I'm very excited. The energy for that is flowing. And it's hard when I'm not at my writing desk for me not to wonder, will this be like one of those other manuscripts that won't finally find a publisher or a readership? And I have to just acknowledge that is a question there and not pay it any attention.
Wow.
Not give it my attention because who knows?
Who knows? But it's a discipline. It is another discipline to be able to be okay with the ones that are still in your drawer or on your bookshelf and know that you gave your heart to them. Mm-hmm. You gave them your work. They carry you and they may or may not ever hatch out into the world and have that be okay. Some people I talk to on the show have a creative life that has been supported because they have a partner who works a day job, you know. Mm-hmm. And neither of you, as I think, are working day jobs. So does that introduce an element of uncertainty into your life?
Or, sure. Yeah, sure. And it introduces a lot of opportunities to talk about the fears that come up around those issues.
Yeah.
And to kind of figure out how do you navigate that. If you have two artists mm-hmm. like that in the same family, and that's an ongoing moment by moment thing. Sometimes, you know, we go for long patches where you don't think about it because you're so engaged with what you're working on. And then again, like Tom was saying, in fallower times or where it's not selling or something, you can feel more panicky about it. But I find that the older I get, the more I recognize that it's always cyclical. And even after fallow times in the past, something happens as long as you just keep, you know, try to keep an aspect of yourself flowing and find things that you can do that make you feel creatively successful that aren't dependent on that financial validation of it. That helps a lot. I find that helps a lot. And also to try to create things that you do have more control over, like the Cozy Grammar series I've been doing for 25 years now. And it's, you know, things like that you're not as dependent upon someone else because you're the one in control of it. And it's got a built-in, after all these years, you know, two or three generations of people have been utilizing it. And
let's just tell people what that is because it's delightful. I've seen, you know, the videos. It's a video-based introduction to grammar principles mm-hmm. inspired by the work of Marie Rackham.
Yes. It came to be because I was living in Los Angeles working in Hollywood and Marie was diagnosed with terminal breast cancer and she was, you know, many years older than me. She was like a surrogate mother, best friend, soulmate figure in my life. And when she told me she had been diagnosed with a terminal cancer, I asked her, well, what can I do to help? And she said, I just want to be where cancer isn't. And so I thought, because I'd been taking some classes in my downtime at the American Film Institute, and I wanted to try to produce something. And had been, you know, so I suggested to her, well, what if we, in between your treatments, these aggressive treatments they were going to do, as long as you feel up to it energetically, why don't we produce something? And you were such a great classroom teacher and funny, and I always thought she'd be good on camera. She said, yeah, I love that idea. And she loved the idea of shooting it outdoors on beautiful locations and picking a crew of people that were funny and, you know, earthy for her to be around. And it ended up working beautifully that her prognosis originally was for like maybe a year at the most, but she responded well to all those initial aggressive treatments. And she ended up living for 5 years, and we just kept producing as long as we could. And she lived long enough to see a reception to a lot of the earlier, you know, the beginning levels that we put out initially while she was still alive. And then some of the more advanced stuff didn't get released till after she died.
And it's still going strong then.
It's still going strong because her legacy is still there. But there was a whole nother level to it that we'd wanted to introduce to do with how you apply a lot of, you know, why do you need to learn all this grammar?
Right.
You know, how does it apply to your creative life? As with that always being the goal, is what serves our creativity. And so when Tom and I got together, it was wonderful to discover that Tom is an amazing teacher himself. And so what we did was we went back and for every lesson that Marie had done on an adverb or an adjective or whatever, then Tom would do a companion lesson in the original same location in Canada where we shot.
Wow.
But he would approach it from a professional writer's perspective of why it was useful and give, you know, tangible reasons why it was useful, and then offer exercises that you could do in conjunction with Marie's exercises.
And then did you know that he had acting talent as well when you began the process?
Well, I knew he would be good because I knew he was a really good classroom teacher. He'd won awards as a classroom teacher at earlier stages in his life. And I'd seen him perform doing his magic or doing poetry or doing book readings. So I knew that was no problem. And it just worked out beautifully because of COVID, as it turned out. It gave us a project we could do that only involved us, because technology had changed so much. When we began the original series way back in like 1998, we needed a crew of like 15 people and all this equipment and clunky cameras and lights. But things have become so much simpler and easier that we were actually able, because it was just him teaching into the camera. So I could set up the lights, I could do the camera work, I could do it, we could do it
fabulous.
All and not interact with other people. So that's why we went back into the wilds of Vancouver Island to shoot the original ones. And then we just shot where we live on Vashon, just on our own. We live on this 13-acre woodlot, and our yurt is sort of in the center of it. And we just utilized those woods, and we turned the yurt into a character in the series. In the original series, Marie taught all the lessons in and around her cozy beach house on Vancouver Island. And we made it seem as if Tom was co-teaching with Marie, but he was mostly based in his cozy writing yurt that was in the woods behind her beach house.
Oh, sweet.
So it would be like they traded off in the lessons, even though they never actually met in life.
Well, I'm glad that's continuing to go. And you also, I don't know whether there was a cozy series, but didn't you make some goofy videos together during the musical
videos?
We also
did Broadway.
Yeah.
Broadway in the Yurt, they were called. And that was just a fluky thing because we were doing it just purely for fun. But the second or third one that we put out, it got, the New York Times got somehow picked up on it because they'd put out something in their Modern Love column about couples that were stuck in, in tiny spaces during COVID, and they wanted to know what that experience was. So I had responded to that and said, well, this is how it's been for us. And part of that was a link to these videos we'd been doing to have a common creative thing to do. And so they were taken with it enough to put the video on the New York Times, on their online version of the New York Times, and then also wrote about it in the paper New York Times. So suddenly we had a much bigger audience for these videos.
Amazing.
So we just kept making them through the pandemic and ended up doing, I think, 15 of them.
Wow.
And so that was a lot of fun, and very different than working on the Cozy Grammar videos.
Right.
So
now you guys did the performance of a lifetime when you did the Gay Beret.
Yeah.
And the Driftwood Bridge. And I felt how moved I was, and I saw how moved the audience was, both as a presentation at your wedding, but also when you performed at the Vashon Center for the Arts and all. I want to ask you two things, because it sounded like you were going to go out on the road with it and then COVID hit. But tell me about that experience, because I know it started as an offering for your beloveds who came to your wedding, but also what was it like to be that open and that vulnerable you know, vulnerable on a couple levels, because I don't know that people who are straight have a have an opportunity to look into the heart of a gay couple in the way that you offered us. And it wasn't just about gay love. You took us to a place where we saw the possibility of a relationship and the healing potential in that.
Yeah.
And I think everybody felt uplifted by the performance. But what was it like to be that vulnerable?
Well, that's part of our, that's part of that, to me, it's part of that practice of living in the moment, is being present to what you're feeling and being vulnerable. And to be an artist, you've got to be vulnerable. And I find the more vulnerable you are in the work you create and put out there, the more the same we are underneath our superficial differences. But the vulnerable stuff is the universal stuff. And if you go there and share yours, it invites people to feel comfortable and safe to share theirs. Or even if you just create in a performance way, you become like a something that people can project their own feelings onto and then privately, quietly reflect on why did they react so much to that later. And just, it just, to me, it ends up feeling the opposite of vulnerable.
Yeah.
In a way, it feels safer in the world to share with a group of strangers in a theater setting like that, and to feel that reciprocal exchange that happens is, it's strange because it is very vulnerable, and yet at the same time, it almost feels more vulnerable when you're guarded and you're trying to hide things or present yourself in a way that's not authentic. Mm-hmm. So.
And for you, Tom?
Well, Well, one of the interesting things about doing a show that asks you to be vulnerable like that is you learn, I learned, that there are different kinds of vulnerability in different places where it's easier or less easy to be vulnerable. And I think, you know, looking back at the show, there are certain ways that I was able to be very free about my experience. In other ways, I perhaps was still a little more guarded. Perhaps in ways I wouldn't be as guarded if, when we continue working with that on that show. But there was also the chance, because we wrote the show together, we composed the music together, I arranged the music. There was also the sort of the vulnerability of like, I'm being more of an actor as well as a singer and a writer, and also writing some of the songs and also arranging the songs and also performing them. So there was a kind of artistic vulnerability involved also. And that was very meaningful for me as well, just to sort of put it all out there, because my life has happened in such a way that I did have a chance to learn the piano and I did learn to sing, and I have enough music theory and background in jazz and gospel piano that I can compose and I can do some arrangements. And the chance to sort of put all that out there was one of the joys, one of the challenges and one of the joys of doing that show.
I know in the audience, some of us are going, these guys, it's like they hit the talent jackpot, you know, to be able to, because we've, you know, a lot of us have known you from just sort of real life and, you know, and then to see the singing, the acting, the music, the piano, the sets,
yeah,
you know,
a
beautiful set.
Trains that Tom folded.
Yeah. I mean, gorgeous.
Rainbow.
Gorgeous. You know, who will ever forget that? You know, there was so much to it. It was so beautiful. Are you continuing? Is that still alive for you, or will there be something else that you
take
on the road?
Well, that's a great question.
A good question.
I'll just say, you know, we had done it for our wedding in 2018, 2019. We began the process of developing it as a freestanding theater piece, performed it at Vashon Center for the Arts, and then we're scheduled to perform it in Seattle at 12th Avenue Arts in fall of 2020. Well, we all know what happened to theater and many, many other things in 2020. We ended up doing a residency at 12th Avenue Arts. We postponed our booking in the theater till the fall of 2021 in the hopes that by then we would be able to offer it publicly. It turned out it was still too early. People are still too reluctant to go out to the theater. So we changed that into a sort of developmental residency. And we'd had another developmental residency at Centrum in Port Townsend in the spring of, no, January 2021. And so we'd continued working on it. But we also found ourselves, you know, uncertain how, of course, with the whole pandemic, how to, you know, just at the practical side of finding venues and how do you tour a show like that with the two of us doing basically everything. And we took it as a chance to look at you know, where we wanted to work on the show and where we would want to work on taking the show out there. And so it's still very much a live thing. It's not at the center of our attention right now, but it very well will be again sometime soon is my best guess.
It's always sort of bubbling in the back of our minds, and we talk about it sometimes. But it's also, again, this idea of being present. And that show, you know, was sort of reflecting on us meeting and our backgrounds that had kind of gotten in the way of feeling worthy of having a partner and stuff, and the people that come into your life, like the Maries and the people that Tom had that had helped him heal a lot of that. And then it ended triumphantly, you know, with saying yes to marriage. And what we both find kind of more interesting now that we've been married for all these years since, and had been living together for 9 or 10 years before that, so 16 years almost altogether, is exploring, you know, that idea of happily ever after, that the wedding is now, it's happily ever after. But it's so much more juicy and interesting to explore, is it really so happily ever after? You know, that's when a lot of the, a lot of your deeper stuff in that safe place you've created together is where a lot of your deeper stuff can come up and be hopefully lovingly worked through to much deeper levels. And that process of that has been so fascinating. And I feel we don't see much of that, like the nitty gritty of the challenging parts of relationships and how do you navigate all of that?
Oh, I think that'd be a great one. When you performed, I don't know when Washington legalized gay marriage, but we were still sort of on the cusp of that, like just celebrating. Finally, we did it. Mm-hmm. No. But now it's reality. And now there are a lot of gay couples who are married, who are living together and finding out what it's like to
and
be.
And they have the same challenges and divorces.
In relationship and
all of that.
All of that. So.
And so. I just think that the whole, our whole culture, there's this whole thing about, you know, the fairy tale idea that once you find that your prince charming or your princess charming or whatever, that life is just wonderful. And then people are gobsmacked to discover when all of that hoopla dies down and here you are and your stuff, your deeper stuff starts coming up. You can only maintain your best self for so long until the cracks, the stuff is going to come up. And I'd always thought that the whole point of a relationship should be about growth. That's when it gets exciting. It's like, okay, we're feeling safe enough for our deeper stuff to come up. Now, how do we learn how to best hold that space for each other that's safe so that we don't just start to think, oh my God, we made the wrong choice. You're not my soulmate at all, you know?
Yeah.
But realize, no, it's like, that's the whole point, to have that stuff come up, to heal it on a deeper level. And to everything you do be about encouraging each other to be your best, healthiest, most satisfied, joyful, fully human self.
I would love to see whatever collaboration you would come up with that would explore that. Let me ask you one last question, and this one, I don't even know how I would answer it, but how do you articulate the need for creativity, self-expression, however you want to talk about it, in these times? You know, I was on a conversation last weekend with people across the world who were exploring, what's the role of the artist? What do we do when it gets really as dark as it can be out there? Do you have any thoughts about that? Are you able to stay with your creative projects and let the world just do what it does? Or what is the relationship of a creator to a world at risk?
I came to the different forms of artistry. I came to the wholehearted embrace of the different forms of artistry that I practice as a form of service, as my form of service. And that involves, for me, all of my being and all of my life and all of my relationship with David also. And so while in times as troubled and as dark as ours are and can be, there are just as many ways to respond to those times as there are people in the world. And my response has been and continues to be to do my work, to do my artistry, and to do the inner work that is also part of my artistry. And I would also say that I think, now I'm speaking more as a writer and as a poet and as a translator, that you know, we're seeing a breakdown of the old words, an old language, the old ways we used to talk about power, relationships, privilege. What is a good life? What is a good country anyway? And I think one of the ways that particularly literary artists and poets can be of service, and one of the ways that I mean to be of service, is to help bring into being the new language that I think many of us are yearning for, a new way of speaking about these things that trouble us. Because it's not just that we live in difficult, trying times, but even to think about those times, even to articulate how we feel about those times, even that is a problem. Even that is a kind of impasse. And I think it is the artists, and not just the literary artists, but people who give us their visions through visual art, who help us to hear newly, to hear the music of life afresh through musical forms of art. All of these things can have, and I believe we are asked to offer work that helps us see, imagine, conceive our experience afresh for the new possibilities that I think are being born as the old is dying out.
Mm-hmm. Brilliant. I'm going to want to replay those words a lot, mm-hmm. because they're so moving, and it also speaks to me to part of the problem that I'm having with current dialogues is that we're dissecting the old and feeling so despairing, you know, as we see things crumbling apart. Mm-hmm. But I also listen to the voices who can speak the new language or offer the glimmers of light or the elementary pieces of art or just the new way of conceptualizing that offers us something to go towards. And so in what you were saying, I felt that. I felt like the role of the artist is to begin to imagine part of what could be. At the same time, we're despairing about, you know, everything falling apart. And David, do you have, you know, a piece to add there?
Yeah, I would just say, you know, personally, it's a weird balance between being very open-eyed and paying attention to everything that's going on, but not getting sucked into the despair. It feels like those Dementors in Harry Potter. You just get sucked out and you just want to go to bed and, you know. And so for me, practically, I find I have to have a broader sense of practicing creativity in the sense of not just the big things that other people see, like shows and performances and things like that, but just being very conscious of being appreciative moment by moment, present to the way the light is on the leaves outside the yurt, or, you know, making something for us to eat that I'm enjoying just putting it together. And, you know, maybe we don't get to work as early as we did, and we take an extra half hour in the morning to just have snuggle time, mm-hmm. to just snuggle, check in, just be present with each other consciously before we go into our separate activities of the day. Going to Zumba. Mm-hmm. It's always, that's my thing. Going for long walks is like meditation for me. And going to Zumba is just, I can tune out. I just watch the person that's leading or other people dancing, like you are always a wonderful generator of some positive energy watching you dance. And you know, just trying to be really conscious of those things that give me a little bit of a respite from the heaviness, because I believe it's in that state of kind of calm is where those inklings, where those little directives will come to sort of, you know, guide us into what do, how to best serve these times.
Absolutely. And for me, because I think about this a lot, that piece of presence that you spoke about, where you're present, you're in your body, you're appreciative. It's almost like a little antidote, like a protected zone that allows you to get out of the mind spin that is so prevalent out there and into a place where we can navigate, you know, we can be whole again. So, mm-hmm. yeah. And Zumba is always, you know, it's not meditative, but it is a chance to live in the now and move your body, which is another piece of the puzzle, just to move your body.
Move
and
your
all.
Body and your brain, having
and
to pick
smile.
Up the choreography.
And smile. And smile. And smile and move and stuff.
Smile and have a bit of community with the other like
super sweet
people.
Yeah. I could talk to you for another hour, but in Radio Land, I better sign off. But I want to have you back. There's so much we could continue to explore. So blessings on you both. And this has been a real treat for me.
Thank you, Sally.
Thanks so much for listening. I look forward to being back soon and bringing you another conversation with an island creative who can show you how it's possible to embrace your muse and live your richest and most creative life. Till then, thanks for joining us, and thanks to Voice of Vashon, 101.9 FM, for hosting this show. I'm your host, Sally Fox, and I look forward to being with you soon.